Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Well, we're up on the road in Boston. For many years, I've heard about the NEARAX, the New England Cask Festival, and I finally get to come up here. The one reason I'm really excited about this is that this month we're going to celebrate Cask Ale. And why Cask Ale? We're going to learn more about it, but also it's the ultimate on-premise drink, and it's the kind of thing that maybe in your pandemic or sitting in the living room, you get a little tired of cans. It's not in cans. It's in person, and many of you know what a good cask ale can be. We've had Duchess Ales on a few years ago, but we haven't really had a cask show in a while just because there's been no cask and no on-premise. So now we're back, and NEARAX is back, and it's really important. I was here earlier for the industry session and just hearing the passion and the memories of so many people that have come to this festival over the year. We're with some of the organizers. So that's the longest intro I've ever done, and hopefully it does justice to these gentlemen. So we're going to go around the room. They're going to say their name and what their role is at the NEARAX.
Hi, I'm Mark Bowers, and my position is president of CASC, which is the nonprofit organization that presents NEARAX every year.
Hi, I'm Jan Williams. I coordinate the main beers for the festival, and I run the door here at NEARAX.
Hi, I'm Gary Chaporian. I'm the festival organizer for NEARAX, and I do other various and sundry things that other people aren't doing, so whatever needs to be done.
Well, it's amazing that this is a machine that's been running for over 20 years, and it seems to be a huge value to the drinking and beer community. So, Mark, you just give us the intro, man. NEARAX, what is it? And, you know, why are you guys involved with it? Just the backstory. Like, when did it start? When did you get involved?
Sure. It started in 1997 in a restaurant pub near here in the Northeast. And I wasn't involved at that point. I had heard about it, but wasn't able to make it. George Gendron, our founder, started it with a handful of casks. He was a Anglophile, loved going over to England for cask beer, and decided Americans needed to try it too. He started that maybe 2-3 years after that. I joined, started drinking at the festival, and decided I'm going to volunteer because it just fit right into my alley. I thought people needed more beer. And then I've been with the group ever since about 2000.
Well, you know, it's my first time here. It really, I don't want to say reverence, but there's a special feeling here. A lot of history and heritage. Jan, you want to tell me about when you first started coming to this and some of your anecdotes?
Well, yeah, actually, I was living in the UK in London and went to a beer festival in London, the Great British Beer Festival, which is kind of the granddaddy of all beer festivals in our world. And talking to the guy running the American bar, and I said, man, how come we can't get cask in the United States? And this was Jonathan Tuttle, one of the founders of NEARAX. And he says, you idiot, we have a festival in Boston. So that's how I ended up here.
And then Gary.
So I started a little bit later than these guys. I attended the second one. I was at a restaurant down the street from where the hall is, and I saw a little 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper on the wall said, "Hey, Cask Ale Festival." I said, "Well, ale, I know what that is. So it's beer, so I'll go. It sounds cool, you know?" So I went to it and kind of just seemed like a really fun thing. And a few years later, I think I attended for a couple of years, and then I started volunteering. And then after a few years after that, they asked me to join the group. So, and then just kind of since then, I don't know, I was probably, I actually, people ask me when I joined, and I say, I don't remember. It's the years are fuzzy, and I can't remember when it was.
It's amazing when something's been going on for so long, you can't even remember when you first went. So let's talk about the mechanics of this, because I mean, I remember back in the late aughts, you know, places like Jimmy's Number 43 and other places in the East Village in New York City, people were putting together mini cast fests. And there were funny things, like you had to buy a card, and you could pay per drink or something like that. It was definitely foreign. I think it was like someone tried to take an English cast festival and put it in New York. They never quite really worked in New York. People started, the terminology was like real ale festivals. But I know you guys say cask condition. So who wants to tell me what the difference is between these English cask condition beers and other things like just filling up a Franconia style keg?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. So first of all, the real ale from Camera is a group in the UK that decided to preserve real ale, which they ended up calling, they thought all of the non-cask conditioned beer, the draft beer that's pushed with CO2, was dead. It was artificial. It just was bland. It wasn't quite right. So they came up with the moniker real ale. But real ale is essentially cask conditioned ale. So that's where we decided to stick with the term cask conditioned ale support campaign, NERAX New England Real Ale. We kept the real ale, but we also kept the cask conditioned, because any beer can be cask conditioned. It can be a lager. It doesn't have to just be an ale. So we knew craft beer was evolving in the US, and people were doing all sorts of crazy things with beer. And whereas the UK was kind of stuck in the beer that was around 1973 when Camera started, they kind of froze what they called real ale. And they have a definition for it, of course. Real ale is made with traditional ingredients, traditional style beers that are put into a cask with yeast, and it's and conditioned and carbonated in the cask, and it's served from the container that it was put into. That's kind of their definition. We kind of expanded that a little bit and said, well, it doesn't have to be traditional ingredients. It doesn't have to be an ale. It could be a lager. You could throw in coconut. You can throw in different things like that. So we moved the bar a little higher in terms of what we decided to accept for it.
Great. And in the planning of this, what are some of the challenges? I mean, I know there was a pandemic and it wrecked a lot of on-premise and festivals, but this year alone, this festival was meant to be 2 weeks ago. So why do we have to wait 2 weeks? What are the special handlings of the cask conditioned ale that are important?
Sure. So it's actually 3 weeks, if you want it for a fact. But the reason we did that was because the real challenge for this is to get the beer from the UK. And it comes on a boat. And so we had to work with a new importer this year, because the old importer we had, who we've basically gotten it since year one, I think, pretty much, shipped over. They went out of business during the pandemic. They were importing for the whole Northeast, you know, a lot of European beer. And so we had found a new importer, and they were kind of learning the ropes with us. And we thought we actually had it all set up. And the beer was coming over in a boat, and it was on the boat, and we thought it was all set to get here in time. And then we found out a couple days later that the boat was stopping in Antwerp, Belgium for a week. So they didn't tell us that when the beer went on the boat. So that's why we were actually going to get it like the day after the festival ended if we kept the original date. So luckily the hall we're at in, you know, South Boston had a the time we needed to do it, you know, 3 weeks later. So that's why we did that. So it worked out okay.
And big shout out to the South Boston Lithuanian Citizens Association, which through meeting Friends of Nerex, we also host our Bowl of Zol Mezcal Festival and also our Cider Feast Boston. So big, big cheers to those guys in Ghent. Thank you. So when this beer comes in, I mean, I know having run a beer bar, even just getting in industrial, I call them industrial craft beer casks, you got to let them sit a little bit. So from the time the beers come and they're unloaded into the time that they're delivered to this venue, what's the process? Do they have to settle? Do you have to inoculate them? Like, I don't know what you guys do on your end.
So I think when you say inoculate, you mean condition, really. So the brewers actually add the sugar to various forms of sugar, whatever they want to use to condition the beer, and then they seal them up. So they're already ready to go. We can open them and add findings to if they want us to. We ask them and they tell us. We can add findings to clarify the beer if that's what they so want. But once we get the beer, it's in that state. We get them in here in the hall. We rent the hall from Sunday to Sunday, even though the festival doesn't start until Wednesday. So we have basically set up on Sunday and then have 2-3 days to get the beers up where they need to be and then let them sit, and you know, so they're nice and rested and ready to go. And then they, you know, we test them all, find out which ones. We'll put a bunch up and ready, but then we try them all to see which ones are ready to go, you know, for each session. That's kind of one of the fun things, I guess, is that the tasting all of them to see which ones are ready to go. So,
the enthusiasm for cask condition ales, Jan, I mean, what got you turned on to this besides that it's a great volunteer organization?
Before we get into that, I got to say, Gary mentioned the beer comes on a boat. In the old days, when we were a little bit less organized than we are now, sometimes we were a little late ordering the beer. And when that happened, we had to fly it on a cargo plane, which means it's very expensive beer. And I can remember 2 or 3 times where we did that. And we'd be sitting there in a meeting and saying, oh, my God, we're going to fly it again. whatever it took to get here in time for the festival.
So tell me more about this organization, because this isn't just a little one weekend festival. You guys, when do you start planning? And tell me about this organization, Cask.
Okay, Cask is a nonprofit organization that we set up probably about 2009 or something. I forget the exact year. And we did that too because we were kind of outgrowing having several people financing it from their own bank accounts and everything, and wanted to become a little bit more legitimate and with the times and everything. So we set that up, and that's CAST, the CAST Conditioned Ale Support Campaign. And after that, that's the organization that sets it up, and we've done a lot of planning, because over the years, a lot of things have changed. Planning, so we have to buy a lot of equipment. The equipment that we use, the hand pumps are expensive. We don't have the brewers come in with their beer and set up a jockey box, which is a little portable thing to serve the beer out of. We own all of the equipment, and so we put it up on stillage, which is scaffolding. We own the casks, the empty firkins and pins that are used to house the beer, the hand pumps, the bars, which we've made in-house. We have chilling units and saddles, and all this equipment is very expensive. So we've spent time over the years as we've grown able to buy all of this equipment and set up. Then we have to start planning for the thing. We have to go out and solicit brewers to see if they'll make cask beer. We've got to get in touch with our people in the UK and the importers to get beer over. We've got to organize food. We've got to organize, get a hall. So there's just a lot of moving parts to set this up. The volunteers, they're the most important part of the entire festival, is the volunteers. If you didn't have people working and helping and pushing this thing, it doesn't matter whether you have just the beer or whatever. It's important, obviously. But if the volunteers aren't there, you're not going to have the beer, you're not going to set it up, you're not going to let it age, you're not going to serve it, you're not going to check people in at the doors, sell tickets, all that stuff. So then we do a lot of planning over, we probably start 4 or 5 months ahead of the festival and then do a lot of planning.
So where do you have your meetings and what do you drink at the meetings?
Usually we have the first one at my house just to kind of kick it off, probably a little bit before Christmas time. After that, we either someone's house or we'll find a place that will let us go there and hang out and have a little, meeting, usually 2 or 3 hours every couple of weeks. It depends where we go. We do like to go someplace that has cask on, obviously, if we can. So we try to find pubs or bars that do that. Sometimes we'll do it at a brewery and someone will put something on just for us because we're going there. So if we tell them ahead of time. Sometimes Mark works at Aeronauts, so sometimes we'll do one there and he'll take care of us. So, about 5 or 6 meetings, I'd say we do. And then a lot of, 1997 when it started, I wasn't there, but I'm sure it was a lot more, just phone calls and things. Now you have email and text. It's so much easier to communicate and you can do things, more real time like that. So it's nice.
Jan?
The whole process of what we do as an organization is pretty complicated, but I'd like to bring us back to the basics just for a second about what this is all about, cask ale. When you take yeast, most people know that yeast makes beer. But what really is going on, and you got these little organisms, if you treat them right and give them some sugar, they produce two different things. Their liquid effluent is something we call alcohol, and they also pass gas that we call CO2, which carbonates the beer. And the whole concept here with cask ale is that's all we want, is what the yeast are doing. This is not complicated. So, that's all of these complicated steps are preserving that natural cask ale and bringing it to the public.
Wow, this is really cool. Definitely, I'll say this, coming in for the first time, I don't know that many people in the beer industry in Boston, but I saw Chris Loring from Notch, Max Tosti, former Deep Alum, new Deep Alum, Todd Mott from Tributary, and Paul Saylor from Flatbread. Why don't you tell us about some of the breweries of note that are here? I know that I remember having Coniston or Ridgeway from England years back when occasionally I'd get a cask in New York City. Let's just go around the room, a couple of your favorites, because there was one called Thunderbird that Ethan, formerly of Deep Alum, just kept saying, it's my favorite, but don't tell anyone.
Oh, yeah. I definitely like coming for the UK beers because they've had, Pete said at our industry trade session, the UK has been doing this for 10, 20 years, 50 years, even several hundred years, and they fine-tune beers on cask. So I definitely tend towards the UK beers and some of the brewers. I remember early on we had Young's Beer, and they're out of business over in the UK now. Fuller's, those were like some of the beers that we got early on. And then as time went on, there's a number of other ones from the UK have come through. Fine Ales, they do one of my favorite beers is Jarl, which is the first brewery in the UK to use Citra hops. So it's interesting, the brewing traditions in the US, the UK brewers have picked up some of our tricks or the things that we've been doing and taken that and run with it like hops. And we on the American side have taken their different yeasts and malts and things like that and brought that in. So it's a really nice kind of mix up of the two cultures.
Yeah, and historically, when you mentioned Todd Mott, the very first Nirax had 3 beers, total of 3, and in the basement of Red Bones. And one of those beers was Todd Mott's. So he was there at the beginning. So historically, it was great to have him here today.
And then do you request certain beers, or do you give the breweries the option of sending? Because I know Todd Mott's Tributary had a California Common, and that's what he drank next to me, and he says, I'm drinking the California Common, so I'm drinking California Common.
Well, I think so. For U.S. breweries, we have one person who runs the kind of show for you getting the U.S. beer procurement, and I'd say five or six other people, as well as he, that we just take different geographical areas in New England. So, you know, Jan does Maine, Mark and I do Vermont, I do Central Mass, other people do like Western Mass, Connecticut, or, you know, whatever, New Hampshire, all that. So we each take an area, and a person who runs it says, you get five, you get six, you get four, whatever, and it just kind of adds up to the total. For UK beer, we have... through our connections from GBBF and other things, we have brewers or camera people over there.
Just tell us what GBBF is.
I'm sorry, Great British Beer Festival. That's like the biggest beer festival, pretty much biggest cask ale festival in the world for sure. It's like a week long in London in summertime. So we have acquaintances from there, so we might know a brewer who's in Wales, we know one from Scotland, or different areas in England, and they'll just get the beer, and they'll, you know, one guy got 10 from Scotland and 10 from Wales and whatever, and they do the same thing over there, and they consolidate to ship it over.
So you know all the beers when you drink. Do you end up with a favorite, or is part of this festival that you have too many favorites?
Well, first of all, we get different beers every year. It's not like you know you're going to get the same beer every year. But I find the favorite beer I have usually. I think one thing about cask ale for people that don't know about it is you can a preface here is that you could be at a bar and get a cask ale and it may taste terrible because they might have had it sitting there for 2 weeks. It's really supposed to be drank in 2 or 3 days unless it's being protected from the oxygen, you know, a little bit, and then it might last a couple weeks. But every day that beer is going to change how it tastes because the oxygen may... will affect it in some ways. Typically, the first couple of days it gets better, and so, you know, if it's too long, it can get worse. So to say I have a favorite, it depends on the day, because my favorite beer today may not be as good tomorrow, and another beer got better. So that's what I love about it, is that I don't have to have a favorite until I've had it, and then I have six beers later. You know, small samples, not big ones. Six beers later, I might find something even better, or I have something I had yesterday that today is even better. So that to me is the fun of it. Is you don't say, oh, I had that yesterday. You say, oh, I wonder what it tastes like today.
Ethan from Deep Elm said that he'd come here on Wednesday. He was still drinking the Thunderbird, and he told me what it was like every day. I wish he was here. So for bars and tasting rooms, let's give them some advice, because, like I said, I remember the time when there were a lot of bars and restaurants trying to do cask. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. Right now we're back. We're back on premise. I know that what's exciting, Max Tosti reopened Deep Elm. In another town, I think Waltham, and they're featuring like one cask a week. What advice do you guys have for on-premise, you know, bar and restaurant owners that really want to get into the cask program? Because I know right now, like in Hudson Valley, there's Duchess Ales. They've been doing cask condition for a while, and my buddy Good Word Brewing down in Georgia, he's going to have something, you know, some kind of hand pump. It's out there, but, you know, bars and restaurants to me are still the core of my on-premise experience.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And the issue with cask beer is it's not plug and play like keg beer. You just put it in the refrigerator, you stick your connector to it, coupler, and then you just start pumping it and pushing it out with CO2. So there's cellaring. So part of the beer brewing process is the cellaring, knowing when it's ready, like Gary says, and then serving it and knowing when to pull it off if the beer goes bad. So you can't, so it's gotta be cooled. It's not low refrigerator temperature, it's cellar temperature, which is like 50 degrees, 55 degrees Fahrenheit. And once you breach it, you vent it, you open it up to the atmosphere, as Gary says, the beer's will improve for a couple days generally, and then it starts going downhill. So some of these people throw the cask on and you got to let it settle. So the worst possible thing to do for cask beer, take the cask out of the refrigerator, you throw it on a table, and you immediately vent it, and then put a tap in it so you can serve it. The beer is unsettled. It's probably squirting out of the top and making a spray. And then the beer that comes out, it may be cloudy because it still has yeast in it because it hasn't been allowed to settle after it's been vented. And then they pour it. So it's going to be kind of crappy to start with. Maybe, you know, in a few hours or so, it gets good and it's kind of nice. But then after that, it starts going downhill because now it's warming up. They don't have it in a refrigerator. So you really need to keep it cool, cellar temperature, and you need to let it settle and do all of this stuff and serve it properly. So there's a lot of complexity. It's not hard to do, but someone has to do this each time. And if the beer goes bad and somebody tasted for the first time, says, I don't like cask. It was warm, flat, cloudy, and it just tasted bad. But probably did. So, but getting a really good cask is amazing. So they really need to know how to take care of it. If they want to do that, they need to contact people who do it. We do. Our organization will help people figure out how to put cask equipment in, the proper way of serving it. They have to train their people who serve it, and then when those people leave, which they invariably do, they have to train the next person that comes in and not just say, hey, just start serving this beer.
You know, one thing about this experience is that you got guys like Chris Loring from Notch, who is practically, to me, the pioneer of the Czech-style side pour. And now I'm seeing so many places when they open, whether it's breweries or special bars, are getting that same side pour. I love that he was here today with one of his, I don't know, what do you call that type of cask that Chris had from Notch?
Stitch Fast.
And then in English?
That's
German.
He said in English. In English, it's stitch fast. In German,
like stick something. Stick, yes.
So he had the small, like, you know, something, a little cask, like a Franconian cask that you put on the bar, and he had filled it with some kind of, what was it, Keller beer?
I'd say, just so everyone knows, probably about 5.5 gallons, I would say, give or take. It's converted to English, you know, ounces and all that, but it's about 5.5 gallons.
So how does, I remember that from when I got frustrated with it, I couldn't always get an English cask from my bar, nor afford it, because they do get expensive when they're imported. But the Franconia option, which is like kind of a filled up cask that you put on top of your bar, how do they differ?
As far as?
Well, the difference is, it's this cask conditioning is quite a craft, but I've seen guys in Franconia just literally put hoses and fill the beer and then ship them over.
You have to remember that cask ale is actually living in the container. It's alive. The yeast are alive, and the reason that it changes over a few days is the yeast are still doing their thing. So that, and that's one of the reasons you have to take good care of it, because if you get outside the envelope that the yeast like, they die. And that's not good. So, I mean, we've got a different product. The Keller beer is actually stabilized, filtered, etc. So that's beer that's ready to serve, and it's not going to change a whole lot. So that's the big difference in my mind between the two.
Yeah, maybe just to add a little bit to that, I mean, what Jan says is true, but think of the stick foss as like a pitcher of beer. You pour a pitcher of beer and you bring it out, but now it's in a container and you kind of close it up and you put it on the table. As soon as you pop that open, some of the carbonation is disappearing. So when you serve it over a couple of hours, it starts to warm up a little bit, because generally these aren't refrigerated or kept cool. And then air does get in, so you start losing some of the carbonation. So it does change a little bit, and the carbonation is a little bit lower. So it's actually more like a draft CO2 pushed beer than it is a cask beer.
That's great. So let's talk about your organization, because this is seems to be the most loved and most interesting beer gathering. I'm not going to say festival, because festival has, I don't like the word festival, but gathering in America. And it's not run by breweries. It's not a brewer's guild. It's something totally different. So let's talk about your feelings about this organization. And I want to say the word reverence, because I have reverence for beer. Why there's so much reverence for this tradition of Nirax, and seeing it from my industry friends like Max Toste, and seeing the brewers, like literally seeing, you know, Todd tell me to try his California Common, or Chris Lawrence so proud to bring his little stink tish of his Keller beer. I mean, this is kind of the ultimate beer day for me.
Oh, geez. I think we're all volunteers. We don't get paid to do this. So we do it for the love of the beer. And when you have a really good cask beer, at least in my case, it's revelatory. It's just wonderful to have this at its peak. And especially even with craft beer in the U.S. back in the early 2000s, there just wasn't this depth of flavor, complexity, and just beautifulness in these beers that were cask. And it's like, wow, that the temperature helps, the carbonation being lower, it just brings out much more flavor and aromatics. And then with the yeast and what the brewers have done, when the beer is just right on, it's, like I said, it's just great. And then you get this, like you say, this almost reverence for the thing. And then, you know, light goes off. It says, wow, this is great. And then you say, okay, now where can I find this? And you go to the nearest pub, and they don't have one, or a bar. And if they do have one, they may not be treating it right. So having the festival where all these beers come in, and people from the UK came over and took care of it early on, helped us take care of it in the fest, it just be saying, hey, we got to keep this going. You got to spread the gospel to everybody else.
And guys, I hate to rock the boat, but I'm done with cans. I never drank that many cans to begin with. In the pandemic, everyone put in cans. I'm going to on-premise always, like the old days. Guys, anything else about you want to say about the reverence for this organization?
When you talk to the guys that started Nirax, and I remember asking them when they were around, why did you do this? And they said, you know, we had this stuff in England, and this is the only way we could figure out how to get it here in Boston. So they had to start an organization.
I love that. And Gary, the mechanics here. So what do you, there's a lot of many pieces that go into a festival. You're texting someone now. We're getting ready for the nighttime session. What are you thinking about? What do you have to do in the next 20 minutes?
Breathe, and then I'm drinking water right now. So, festival-wise, we get the hall right. The cellar team is seeing what beers are going to be on, and checking to make sure that there's enough beer on for the night, and planning out the rest of the. We kind of plan every day as we go for that. We have to wash the glassware and make sure it's ready for the next day. If you can take your glass home, but some people return them. And so we have to wash those and have those ready for the next session. We have a bunch of volunteers come in for every session, and we love, like Mark said, we love to get our volunteers. They're great. And so we have to assign them to different areas. We have bartenders, we have stewards that stand around and just to help people if they need help or watch things. And people at the door, Jan runs the door, and we have people at the door that help him. Properties table where we sell shirts and glassware and such. So we have volunteers that come, and we have to get them to their areas and give the people who run the areas have to do little speeches for them before we start so they know what to do. And then we just, honestly, after that, you just kind of deal with everything as it goes. It's the way it is.
That's great, because he was just...
I wanted to add one point about the cast, the Nirax thing and everything. For me, I just love the fact that, we're pretty much agnostic as far as breweries go. We don't play favorites. We don't say this guy's the best and that guy's no good. We give everybody a chance to be on, and we love to have you know, all these brewers that, you know, they want to do this. Sometimes they're only doing this once a year, you know, to make a beer like this, so it's special to them too, and for them to have it there is a special thing for them. So to me, it's just the joy in their faces that people come in. You know, we haven't had a festival since 2019 because of COVID. And so many, we've had it two nights so far, and so many people come in and just want to give me a big hug and say, oh, I missed this so much. We're so happy it's back. And it actually kind of brings back a sense of normalcy, like, you know, COVID's over, NEWAX is back. It's just, I'm sure there's other things in the world like that too, but that's one of the things that people can say, hey, you know, we're finally over this thing. NEWAX is back. We're back to normal again. It just makes us really happy.
Wow, that's amazing. Hey, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I am at NEWAX, the amazing New England Cask Condition Festival in Boston. My first time here ever, talking with some of the organizers. And there's reverence here, guys, because it's back. Cask Ale's back. On-premise is back. We're having a good time. So let's talk about the beers that you can't get, because you've got some good stuff here. I heard Paul Saylor, who's from something flatbread, was talking about Timothy Taylor. And I remember like 12 or 13 years ago, maybe more than that, with my buddy Ray Dieter at DBA, we got a secret stash of Shelton Brothers Timothy Taylor Landlord bottles. And I can still remember just how good it was and that bready flavor. Why can't you get Timothy Taylor casks? And do you guys actually send your cask things back to England?
So what we do is we actually, the Great British Beer Festival that we mentioned before, they have a U.S. bar there, and a U.S. cask bar. So we actually have reps in about, what, six or eight regions in the country. And we send our firkins out to them, and they fill them up. And then we consolidate them here and send them to England for the Great British Beer Festival. So that's how they get our firkins to be able to fill up that, to send back to us. So it's pretty much, you know, they get them, we get them. They, you know, every year it just goes back and forth.
And then who set that up? I mean, this is an amazing, this is a lot deeper than just some of the, I've not to knock anyone, but I've sat in on some cask fest that were trying to be like this or be inspired by it. It's the only way I actually know what NEWAX was New York City 12, 13 years ago, people talking about it.
Originally that was set up with George Gendron and Jonathan Tuttle. And at that point, we were getting casks over from the UK brewers. It was their casks, and then we had to get it back to them. So they said, well, why don't you send back a U.S. beer, cask beer? We'll serve it at GBBF, and then, you know, we'll get back to the brewer. And at some point, they still had a little issue because their casks were over here in the U.S. a little bit too long. And then we said, okay, why don't we just buy our own cask, and then we'll send them out to breweries to fill them, whether it comes directly to us, and then some of them would get refilled and then go over to the UK. So as we were able to grow and our coffers filled up a little bit, that's what we did. We bought the cask, and we have our own, have about 100 or so casks that we use back and forth.
That was really the breakthrough for us, because many of the British brewers, they're interested in selling us the beer and so on, but they're saying, am I ever going to see my cooperage back? And so we own the cooperage. So that issue went away. And yeah, the big benefit is these things go back and forth full, both directions. And that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think that's it. I'm good with that answer.
You're busy. You're thinking about the next session. So we're going to wrap it up soon. There are a couple other questions like camera and stuff. So when this is April, whatever, 21st, but it's going to air in May. We're also going to do a second Cask episode coming up probably next week. It'll be with the guys trying to run Cask Mark here in the States and their reboot of that, and just to see how important that is. But, you know, not too long ago, it was bars and on-premise that were really doing the Cascale thing, and a lot of the new small breweries now are embracing it. The same way I said Chris Loring at Notch is doing the side pour, influencing a lot of people. I think that brewery tap rooms are going to be the first place where people get exposed to cask. Do you guys agree with me?
Oh, absolutely. There is no cask in a can that you can take home and get the experience. So it's got to be at a pub, and it's almost certainly going to be a beer bar, almost certainly. You're not going to see it in the restaurants to start with. So you need someone who's really like Mac Toasty, who really loves beer, has a beer bar, takes care of it. People like that really have these beer bars, they're the ones that say, hey, I love cask. I've been to the UK. We've got to get cask beer here, whether it's coming from the UK if I can get it, or it's made in the US by US brewers. I'm going to get that, and I'm going to serve it right, and it's going to be another line I can pour beer out of.
Gary, when I walked in, I met you, and you got me a beer. It was Wee Something. What was that beer? You said, do you want a bitter? I said, yes. If Gary says bitter, I'm getting a bitter.
Mark's looking up the program. I can't remember. What was that called?
It's Wee. And then Thunderbird. So Ethan from Deep Ellum was talking about Thunderbird. Where is that from?
Yeah, look at the problem is there's about 105 beers, I think, so I haven't memorized them all yet, sorry.
No, it's just, I say the word cube, just the fact that someone has tasted a beer on Wednesday, came back Thursday to taste it, and is tasting it again. And if you feel that way, then this is the festival for you.
You know, I want to comment on this, the growing sophistication of our clientele. When we started out, we would have Fullers and Youngs, because that's what we could get. But that's what American tourists had when they went through London. And so everybody wanted that. Today, I mean, you've seen our beer list downstairs. I mean, there's stuff nobody's ever heard of. And our clientele now wants to see what's new in England that we haven't seen. So, I mean, it's a whole different world. This is really cool. I mean, our colleagues in the UK are coming up with beers that we've never heard of, and they're wonderful. So that's the fun of it for us.
All right, Mark's looking at, there's a great program. So what were some of the beers we wanted to feature?
So the Wee Brow you mentioned, that was from Cross Borders.
And then where is that from?
I just know the UK. It doesn't say in here exactly.
UK is enough. That's fine. Yeah. I don't know if it was from Vermont or somewhere else.
From the UK. Just got to figure out what region in the UK. Because like Gary said, we have like five, I think, or so different regions in the UK that we get beer from. We get from Scotland.
New England and Scotland.
Yeah, the same place, right?
Same border.
It's Cross Borders. Yeah, here it is. We brought is... It's from Cross Borders, and you know what? Most of these actually have the location, and that one doesn't.
Well, because it's Cross Borders, you know? Who knows?
An error in the program. There you go. Okay.
Sounds like contraband to me.
No, it just, most of them say, like, here's Cold Black Label, Bridge End, Wales, and Brew York and York, England, but this one does, Cross Borders doesn't say where it is. We screwed up.
And what about the Thunderbirds?
Okay, that's Glamorgan Brewery, and that's in, now, I don't know if anyone know Welsh, but there's a lot of weird letters and stuff, but I'm going to launch a sign mid Glamorgan in Wales. How do you like that?
So you get to travel through beer.
If it's unpronounceable, you know it's from Wales.
Yeah.
And is there any like thumbs up or gold medals awarded like for best of, or this is just more like you're enjoying and tasting?
We've actually talked about doing something like that in the past, but we decided we didn't want to because we don't really want to tell anybody what they should have and what should be the best beer, because I think if you asked 100 different people, you'd probably get 20 that would say one or 20 that would say another, but you'd get 50 different answers, so I'd hate to say what's the best, you know, so because you're talking probably 6 or 8 people judging it. And then somebody's like, well, what about my beer? My beer is good too, you know, and it's like, we don't want to deal with that. We're trying to stay agnostic and not get into that stuff.
That's really deep in our culture, actually. In the early days, a lot of local brewers were involved in starting and being involved in Nirex. And, I mean, it was gospel in the early days. We ain't having no stinking competition. You know, these guys who are just not interested, just put in great beers and we'll enjoy them all.
One more thing about that, though. When we send American beer to GBBF, they do have a championship medals for different categories, and one of them is American beer. And everybody wants to win that one, so because they want to be like the American beer at the British Beer Festival. That's the one they want.
But we can't talk about that.
Well, I'm not. They did give medals, but you can look them up. They're online. You can look up to one.
We had a beer from Rising Tide in Maine that won a medal. In London.
Not this year.
Yeah, in the prior year.
This is good. Everyone's talking. What I love about this group is that they're so respectful that I reached out and they really didn't want to have anyone come and record or video. And when I was here today, everyone there was enjoying the company and the beer. So for the next episode that's coming up, who wants to tell me about Camera? Because this is like the new face of cask conditioned ale, and this is really the place to come and learn about it. And again, you got to really be into beer. This is not for tourists. But Camera, going way back, you know, we've all read the Michael Jackson book, but for this next generation, maybe it didn't. Who wants to tell me about Camera and the role that played in England and cask conditioned ales?
Well, Jan has been a member of Camera. He's a lifetime member, but they don't give those memberships out anymore. You pay a fee for one time. So he's been a lifetime, and he goes over there probably the most out of anybody here in our organization. So I think let Jan give a shot at that.
Well, you know, the whole thing started modeling the British beer festivals. Because, I mean, they just didn't exist here in the States. But, you know, over the years, when we were doing something and nobody knew quite why we were doing it, the answer always was, well, that's what they do at Camera. So, I mean, that was the easy way out. But, I mean, these guys, for many, many years, had figured out how do you run a beer festival. So we took that as the model. And it's worked very, very well.
Camera's actually, I don't know how many, there's probably 30, 40, 50 chapters in England, Scotland, and Wales, right? I don't know how many. But every region in England, Scotland, and Wales has their own Camera chapter. And they also all have their own festivals. So I'm pretty sure you can go to England, Scotland, or Wales every weekend of the year and find a Camera festival somewhere. Just probably not holidays, but most every other, you know, weekend. So They have, I think, I don't know about now, I think the last I saw there was about 100,000+ people that belong to it, you know, over the 3 countries. And I don't think there's 1,000 people in this country that know what Camera is, so, you know.
Camera is actually, I don't know if it was the first, it might have been the first considered consumer-oriented organization in the world. And at least as of maybe 10 years ago, they were the largest consumer-focused group in the entire world. So they are not like brewers, they're actually more on the punters, the customer's side of beer. They want to go to places and have the bars serve the proper pint. The brewers that are providing the beer to these pubs do it right. They're even incredibly interested in like these glasses, or pint glasses, which I'm holding up. And they have lines on them like ours do, and they also have a line at the top. So they really focus on getting a full pour. If you advertise a pint over in the UK, price per pint, you better get one pint, 20 U.S. ounces of beer in that thing. So they were really coming from a consumer standpoint. But it's had rippling effects throughout the entire industry, both from the pubs, the bars, the restaurants, as well as the brewers, to keep this tradition going and give fair value, good value to the customer.
Yeah, and you know, I will point out, Camera does publish a good beer guide to the UK. And you just cannot, if you're a beer person, you cannot go to the UK without having that guide, because they identify the pubs in every town across the whole UK as presenting acceptable quality beer, cask ale.
Yeah, I do not personally belong to Camera, because when I go to England and Scotland and Wales, I've never been to Wales, but England and Scotland, I just talk to the guys I know, and they tell me where to go. So, but I have used the.
You got the Gary guide to beer.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy with it. But I find though that the best way to if any of you are going to Scotland, England, or Wales to drink cask beer, because keg beer actually is pretty big over there too, and it's kind of a battle between, you know, one versus the other. And I don't think it's a vicious battle. There's, you know, some people are keg people and some people are cask people. But, and you know, it's never the twain shall meet, you know. But I think that if Camera wasn't there, I think keg would have probably taken over by now. So I really do believe what they've done is, I mean, we would love someday to have, you know, 400,000 people in America drinking cask ale and saying that's in you can go down the street and get it. And we're obviously not there. But I also feel like, in our own way, we're better in the New England area. We have more than we would have had if we weren't here, because there are enough people now that do it that we do have some. So I think that we've done that, and in our small way, we're like mini, mini, mini Camera, you know. So, but we've, you know, and so I think that's, I can't just imagine like how they feel over there, the people that set it up and it's become this big thing over there now. I mean, they must feel great about that. You know.
And the last question, does climate have anything to do with it? Because if you're talking about cellar temperature, I mean, Boston is different from, you know, Maryland or other parts of the country where it can be warmer. Do you think that being in Boston is to your advantage for cellar temperature? You know, and I don't want to get into the little details about is it flat and all that. If you've had it, you know it. But just talk about temperature in the cellar in this region. Is could this only happen in Boston? Like, would this be happening in LA?
Yeah, less so, because I think it's not so the weather for the temperature of the beer, but people drinking the beer. I think when you get the warmer weather, the so-called lawnmower beer, I think everybody knows that's like one of the macro lagers. You're tipping it, it's cold. And almost all U.S. beer, canned, bottled for, you know, 100 years or so, has been cold because it's refreshing. And I think you see that more like in hotter places, drinking these lighter alcohol beers that are stone cold because they're refreshing at that point after you've been out mowing the lawn. I think in the colder climates, you might get into like a little bit more malty beers and such like that. Is it easier to keep? Well, once refrigeration came in, that's kind of when lager really took over. They brewed lager all the time, and that's a cold beer, cold condition, served cold, brewed cold, all of that stuff. So I don't know in New England whether it may be more because of the weather and the way people want to drink. So there's a little bit more tendency for that.
You guys might be more sophisticated here. Okay, last thing. We're really going to wrap it up because you guys got to go do that next session. What's your day job? Say your name one more time and we're out of here.
Okay, I'm Mark Bowers, and I'm actually the brewmaster at Aeronaut Brewing.
I was at the original one in Somerville.
I'm still there. I'm still brewing beer. I do recipe development and other R&D type things.
I'm Jan Williams. I'm retired, retired business consultant.
Gary Chaporian, I'm a retired IT professional.
All right, so this is, again, one big shout out to this NERAX, the cask condition, the CCAST. If you love beer, you know that this is the right thing. And, you know, maybe some of you will think about doing something like this in other parts of the country. Really enjoy coming here. The word reverence and and good beer. Again, I remember having those few casks at my old place, Jimmy's 43, that was like a Coniston or a Ridgeway that had been imported properly and the conditioning was right on. Then you knew what we're talking about. It's not just, you know, putting your Imperial IPA in a keg. And we've had some bad ones too. I remember there, when the cask craze got a little out of control in the early days of craft beer, there'd be a brewery coming in saying, we want you to put the Imperial IPA on draft next to it, the cask of Imperial IPA. And people didn't drink either one. So, you know, the styles of beer, we talk about styles, a lot to talk about, and you guys know it. If you're listening this far, you love beer, but the styles of beer alone, I had a Keller beer. I had just some very lightly hopped, you know, different types of ales. I'm really enjoying myself. And I'm going to go back downstairs with these guys. I got tickets. I actually bought tickets for the evening session on Friday. I'm going to try to beat the weekend rush, have a few more of these, and enjoy yourself. So thanks. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host on Beer Sessions Radio. Thanks to Armin Spengen, our engineer, who's going to clean this up. This will be airing in May 2023. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.